Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
Today we're going to talk about British director Ridley Scott. Now, he has been described by many people as the very best eye in the business, and this is going to be made evident by the fact that he started off as an art school student. And to this day, he says he paints all the time. So everything that he does comes from this viewpoint of seeing things as art. While he was at the Royal College of Art, he also helped establish a film studies department at the school. So, you know, that's interesting also. He says he was a terrible student, not because he was lazy, but because he's a multitasker. But he couldn't grasp or retain the information that was coming at him. So he says the saying then was that those who can do, those who can't go to art school. Where do you want to start with Ridley Scott, other than the art background, Mike?
Well, I do actually want to start with the art background for this reason. When I teach a course on British film, which I'm doing again in the fall, there's my shameless self-promotion just for a moment. But anyway, in that course, I don't actually use Ridley Scott on screen, but we talk about him in a generational way. He's from a generation of directors, including others like Alan Parker and Adrian Lynn and so on, Michael Apted. A lot of them had backgrounds going through art school. And in the case of Ridley Scott, you know, he actually worked as a set designer. You know, he actually was thinking, you know, visually that way. And then he starts to work in TV commercials. And this is something that he and his younger brother, Tony Scott, and Alan Parker, other directors, a lot of them were, so some of these directors, they all worked for the BBC one way or another. Some of them worked in documentaries like Michael Apted and so on. But in the case of Ridley Scott, he very quickly morphs into someone who's really known for making TV commercials. Marie, this ties into what you're saying about art school. It's that visual quality. You know, think about a TV commercial. You got like 30 seconds. You got to tell your story fast. You got to grab the audience's attention. You need to be flashy. You need to be slick. And for better or for worse, he has those attributes. That's what makes him known. Now, how I first became aware of him, got to know him that way, when he made his first feature film, it was in the UK, a film called The Duelist. And, you know, with Keith Carradine, Harvey Keitel, I mean, it's a film that had kind of art house exposure. And I actually wrote an essay about it back when it came out to date myself. But, you know, I knew that film, The Duelist, which was very well received, not big box office, but, you know, among the cognoscenti, if you will, you know, a well-known film. And where I did really actually personally get to know Ridley Scott a bit was I interviewed Ridley Scott, Sigourney Weaver, Tom Skerritt, and H.R. Giger, the designer, in New York in 1979 for Alien. Alien was Ridley Scott's first American film. He's actually a relatively new director at this point. And, you know, we talked a lot about that commercial background. So, Marie, we talked about art school. We talked about being a designer, thinking visually, and so on. And I got to say, when I was in New York for that and, you know, talking with them about the film, I saw, if not the first screening of it, one of the very first screenings of the film. And so 20th Century Fox, the producing studio, was extremely skillful at not telling people much about Alien before it came out. There was a huge campaign, but it was like a teaser campaign. You did not see the monster, you know, you didn't really know much about the story. So the reason I share that with you is that during the so-called chest burst sequence with John Hurt, it was a packed Manhattan theater. And, you know, this is like film critics and people in the business and so on. We were so shocked by that scene that I've rarely heard of this mixture of people screaming, actually screaming, and also laughing, but that kind of nervous laughter, that kind of nervous rushed laughter. And the audience never quite recovered from that. At that point, the film was you know, doing its thing very well. And so when I talked with Ridley Scott about the film, I asked him about his, because Alien was a huge commercial hit. It was a big critical success. It made his name in the United States. It made him the Hollywood director immediately that we know him as. I mean, I can't say too much about that. So I'll say it, you know, it's just something that really put him on the map that way. So I asked him about his creative strategy in Alien. Now, in some monster movies, they show you the monster right up front, which is always a big mistake. Because I know, like when I go to see a horror film, when I see the monster in the first 5 minutes, even if the special effects are really good, at a certain point, I get used to it. And I just kind of shrug after about a half hour and say, okay, that's the monster. You know, big deal. You know, give me a dance number I haven't seen yet, right? It's sort of, But the best horror films oftentimes keep it in the wings, just glimpsed. And then you don't get the outright full-on face-to-face horror until well into the film, if ever even. So when I asked Ridley Scott about that, here's what he said. We decided not to show much of the monster because less is always better. It's scarier when not seen. And that's one of the reasons why I think Alien really is one of the most successful, creatively successful horror films. Or, you know, it's sort of a mixed equation. Should you call it? I mean, it's obviously science fiction, but science fiction and horror are so closely allied that it's one of the strongest films of that type, I'll put it that way, that's come out in recent decades. It really made his career.
You know, I think that was the first Ridley Scott movie that I saw, and I saw it in the theater. And what I remember about it was the audience reaction, including mine, because I was holding my purse in my hand. And when the monster burst out, I was waving it in the air and screaming. I do want to go backwards real quickly just to mention that his first directing job was a commercial for Instant Porridge. And he also, you know, made a whole bunch of commercials for the BBC, including many award winners. And he also, his first film was something called Boy and Bicycle. And if you buy The Duelist on DVD, they usually put it on there as like extra feature. But he did this when he was a photography student in art school in 1962. And he wouldn't direct his first feature for another 15 years. But this film is significant in that it features lots of visual elements that would become motifs. It features the cooling tower and blast furnaces of the local British Steel North Works, foreshadowing images in Alien, Blade Runner, and Black Rain. And the film features, as you mentioned, his younger brother, Tony Scott, as the boy. So he says it cost £65 to make and took 6 weeks to bugger about on Red Car and Hartlepool Beach to make the movie. Tony must have been 14, 15, and I ruined his summer holiday, but it was sinking into him, so we were doing a thing that would inject lifelong dedication to making films. So it's really actually quite a strong work for early student work, but by the time you get to Alien in 1979, you know, this is where he really, like you said, makes his mark. Now, while he was doing this movie, he did most of the handheld camera work himself, and he was so bored while waiting for the budget to be determined on the movie that in his spare time, he storyboarded the entire movie. So this is what you would do if you went to art school. You'd think, well, I can't get started. I might as well draw the whole thing, which is what he did. And then when he sent it to the studio, they doubled the budget based on what they had seen on the storyboard. So that's just an incredible way to... That never happens. You know, they never give you more money, more budget. I think they needed it all for what they managed to accomplish in that movie. Now, the director's cut came about when they found over 100 boxes of footage in a London vault. And I mention that because I want to ask you, Mike, they talk about Ridley Scott being like the father of the director's cut. What do you think of director's cuts? Do you like them, not like them? It depends. What do you think?
I would say it depends, honestly. We'd have to talk about individual films as to where it's an advantage and where not. In general, I'm not a huge fan of them because sometimes films are already full enough, if you will, 2 hours or 2 hours plus. And to have an extra half hour or 40 minutes, I don't know. Does it really? I mean, for me, here's one of the great examples. One of the great lost causes, seemingly for many years, was, for reasons it would take too long to get into, Fritz Lang's Metropolis from 1927. And speaking of science fiction as a genre, one of the early landmark films, it's a long film, but for reasons, again, it would take a while to get into, it was boulderized, it was chopped up from the start. And for years, the Holy Grail was to find the missing footage from it. And over time, they found bits and pieces. And then finally, in an archive in Argentina, I think it was, they found the final bits of lost footage. And now, you know, I've seen the full-length film now, and it does add quite a bit of footage. It does fill in some of the blanks in the story. It fleshes out a bit, but it makes a long film even longer. And honestly, Metropolis is a madcap genius work of art. It still doesn't make sense, even with the extra footage. There are aspects of it that just don't parse, don't add up. And so having an extra 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, still, it's just as crazy a film and still as illogical as ever in places. So I give that as one quick side example of how having the extra footage is nice. I appreciate it as much as anyone. But honestly, in an aesthetic sense, it didn't really add that much to it. And so, again, I hesitate to generalize because we could think of other films where having a director's cut was a plus. But generally speaking, I think, you know, give us the film. And unless there's some extraordinary reason why I need extra footage, you know, sometimes producers are right. Sometimes distributors are right. You know, there are reasons to cut down a film, not just because you want to have screenings at 2, 4, 6, and 8, you know, there are reasons why it just might not be necessary. Sometimes the creative artist is so close to the material that he or she, having labored over it, wants to keep everything in. So I never thought I'd be a shill for producers and movie companies and all that. But Marie, you see the point I'm making there is that there are times where, you know, it's advantageous actually to, you know, trim it down a little bit. But again, I'm not going to generalize there because we could easily think of films where having that lost footage really is a treasure to have that restored. So director's cuts, sure. Nowadays, particularly in the DVD era, the impulse is to, you know, maybe it's bottom of the barrel curating, but to find whatever footage was still down there and to put it back in. And, you know, I mean, for instance, like Cinema Paradiso, I wasn't going to give more examples, but I'll give more examples. You see the director's cut there, and it really has a lot of footage you don't need. You don't want to see his romantic relationships. You just want the footage you have already of him with the kid, the relationship between a movie theater projectionist and a small child in Italy back in the day. And having that extra footage doesn't really add to that. So, I would watch the director's cut of Cinema Paradiso, but like never use it in the classroom or actually even never watch it again. It's something to see once.
Although sometimes the extra scenes, you know, you watch them and you think that would have been great in the movie. I'm thinking of Love Actually, which is already too long. It's already more than 2 hours. And then it's got all these extra scenes that I think could have easily been in. I don't know how they make those choices of what to remove. I think that must be excruciating. But speaking of director's cut, brings us to Blade Runner from 1982, where, you know, they're pursuing and terminating 4 replicants who stole a ship in space and have returned to Earth to find their creator. You know, classic science fiction setup, classic movie. But there's 2 versions. There's, you know, one that came out, and then there's the director's cut, which is different in some ways. He thinks Blade Runner is his most personal and complete movie, made on a very tense set, because when he made Alien, he would just pick up the camera himself and do all the handheld camera work. Nobody was bothered by this at all. Because of American Union rules, he couldn't bring his own crew. You know, there were all these strict codes that, you know, he wasn't allowed to operate the camera because that's the camera operator's job. And of course, crew members and producers kept questioning about all his artistic choices. So I think most of the majority of the American crew did not enjoy working on this movie or working with him because they thought he was cold and distant, and he's a perfectionist, and he caused shooting delays that, days of shooting that lasted 13 hours. I mean, he sounds like a very hard taskmaster. But I have used Blade Runner in my American cinema class. I think a lot of people have heard about it to the point that when you show it, there's all this anticipation that, oh, Blade Runner, I've heard so much about it. How do you feel, Mike, about the 2 versions? Do you have a preference?
I really don't have a preference there. I can appreciate what he's doing in both versions, but I don't think a longer film, a more comprehensive film there necessarily adds to it. I think the original release for Blade Runner did it for me. Let's put it that way. I'm talking just as a moviegoer at this point, because push come to shove, I don't want to say that I'm indifferent to the story in Blade Runner, but what really makes Blade Runner work is the obvious visual spectacle. And when you mention his background in art school and making commercials, that slickness, that commercial sheen, if you will, that comes through in any version. You know what I'm saying? Once you have the basic sense of set design in Blade Runner, that's the real creative highlight of the film. The story works, you know, well, so I'm not, you know, dismissing it whatsoever. But it's really the eye appeal. It's really the visual qualities of it. And so I had my fix, basically. I was satisfied with, you know, Blade Runner's originally released. I wasn't particularly looking for more depth psychology or more anything particularly. And I'm not sure the film has as much depth as its biggest fans would say. I think a lot of the, and this is a general statement I will make about Ridley Scott, and I'll come back to this a little later in our program. But push come to shove, he's a highly commercial director, very effective, but oftentimes it's that surface appeal. You know, it's just that good, slick storytelling. And I mean that in the positive sense. And there's not always as much substance there as one might hope for or expect. And a longer cut of the film may or may not add that.
Well, that brings us to my favorite, his movies, which is Thelma and Louise from 1991. And, you know, I've used Thelma and Louise when I've taught women in film. And Ridley Scott comes up because of Alien, first of all, the way he directed Sigourney Weaver in a very strong role, which she's, you know, when she passes away, which I hope is a long time from now, they're going to mention Alien in her obituary. It's the most significant thing that she has done to this point. But Thelma and Louise is even more so, because it's about, you know, it's a road movie with 2 women on the run. You know, they go out on an adventure, and then there's an incident now they're being hunted by the police, you know, while they try to escape from the crimes that they've committed. So in terms of the feminist undertones in his films, Ridley Scott says it's gratifying when people mention that. I remember reading Thelma and Louise and the executives were saying, well, it's two bitches in a car. And I said, actually, it's a little bit more than that. Originally, I was supposed to produce and I offered it to four directors. One said, I've got a problem with the women. And I said, that's the point, you dope. Clearly, you have big problems with women. Now, he would then follow that with Gladiator in 2000. Russell Crowe is there's a former Roman general who sets out to exact vengeance against the corrupt emperor who murdered his family and sent him into slavery. And from the outset, he made it clear that this was a sword and sandals movie that would not feature any of the genre's cliches of people lounging around eating grapes and drinking from goblets. He wanted something more realistic in terms of depicting ancient Rome. And I think that's the thing that gives it its visceral power, is it's hard to watch, it's violent. Well, you might have some things that you want to say about Gladiator yourself.
I wanted to double back quickly on Thelma and Louise from 1991. I use that film in a course I teach on Hollywood in the 1990s. It's a great zeitgeist film, one of my pet words, because it really, in terms of the feminist duo played by Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon, how these two women, you know, bond as friends, how they're on this criminal escapade, if you will, and how it really is a road picture, which is usually a male buddy-buddy kind of setup, but with the two women. It's my favorite Ridley Scott film because it does have a lot of surface appeal in the sense that as a road picture, it takes you through great Western scenery. Mm-hmm. It's really great visually. And it's got Brad Pitt, who's easy on the eyes, right? And so it's got all that appeal to it. But you know what? The characters have more substance. And I feel that the feminist text, it's not even subtext, it's the text, right? Is really, really smartly done. And so, in fact, the screenwriter, Kelly Curry's, you know, got a lot of praise and, you know, in fact, awards for this. And she, in interviews, has said that this film became what she called, quote, part of the culture. And it really did. Everyone who either saw that film or at least knew about it, they knew the references to Thelma and Louise. And so if you were to talk about feminist history, you know, or just women in American society in general, that's one of the films, it's like a primary document. How many films can claim that, you know? And so I did want to double back and talk briefly about that. The chief claim to fame for me in Gladiators is simply that the research was there. The production design is really first rate. You really feel like you're back in ancient Rome, you know? And even though it can be a difficult film to watch, it's very convincing at that level. So when I talk about surface pleasure, again, I don't mean that in a dismissive way at all. There's a lot visually and culturally to enjoy in Gladiator. By the same token, Ridley Scott's films do tend to have a relatively long running time. And you can get to the point where you just feel like, okay, do we need to see yet another match that, you know, at the Colosseum? You know, some of that stuff does get drawn out a bit. And that's where it can be a bit wearing after a while because it's been effective, but then there's just more of it.
Now in 2001, he would make Black Hawk Down, which again, it's a different genre. You know, suddenly it's a war film, but it still has that Ridley Scott feel to it, probably because he storyboarded each shot in advance the way he likes to do. So he thought out the way it looks. It almost doesn't matter what the storyline is, whether it's a road movie or aliens or war, you know, he still approaches everything like with an artist's eye, which brings us to The Counselor in 2013, which is the one movie that I watched that I thought really was not good. And I was surprised because he says he was really happy with the way that turned out, that it was very cynical and too nihilistic for some people, but he likes nihilistic. But he had said once that he doesn't usually have sex scenes in his movies because sex is boring unless you're doing it. And this movie actually starts off with Penelope Cruz and Michael Fassbender, two of the most attractive people on the planet, in bed together. And somehow it's still boring. And the whole movie, even though it's got A-list actors in it, including Brad Pitt, by the way, Thelma and Louise being the first movie he ever made, this was just a complete miss for me. So before we go to the Martian, which is my second favorite Ridley Scott movie, Mike, jump in to mention anything about The Counselor or any of his other movies that you want to make sure we talk about.
Yeah, I think Ridley Scott has had a more mixed track record for the past decade or so. Films like Robin Hood, Prometheus, The Counselor, and I agree very strongly with you on The Counselor. These are films that have some commercial appeal. I mean, they do well for the most part, not always big hits, but they do well enough. but critically get a kind of mixed response. And this is again where I've been hinting at this throughout our conversation, where Ridley Scott has got that obvious surface appeal, but not every film holds up on other levels in terms of scripting, in terms of motivation or what have you. And it seems to me one of the films that's most problematic, even more so than The Counselor, is the film he did right after that, the year after that, actually, Exodus, Gods and Kings. And, you know, it's got a big cast. It's John Turturro and Sigourney Weaver and you know, on, Ben Kingsley, I mean, well-known actors. But it's, you know, in some ways no better than some of those sword and sandal epics of the 50s that people make fun of nowadays. And the New York Times film critic, A.O. Scott, hit it on the nail when he wrote this about Exodus, Gods and Kings, and put it in the context of Ridley Scott's overall career. Quote, "Not for the first time, Scott confuses excessive scale with authentic grandeur." And this is what I was getting at, I was kind of hinting at throughout our talk here, is that there are times where with Ridley Scott, yes, he does the storyboarding, production design, it looks great, visually it's all there as it should be, but you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, you have a great look to the film, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily a great film. And I think, you know, he has that as an issue throughout the career. But Marie, you know what, for every film that, as you described, is a misfire for The Counselor, there are other films that really do hit. And I think The Martian is one of his better films. So let me hand it back to you to talk about it.
Now, I actually used The Martian in my film and philosophy class, which, by the way, I will be teaching this summer and fall. I get that little plug in there. And we use it because it's a great example of the great philosophical questions of, you know, what does it mean to be human? The movie, if you haven't seen it, is about an astronaut who's stranded on Mars and his team thinks he's dead. And then he has to figure out how to tell people on Earth he's alive. Then they've got to figure out how to go get him. So the, you know, the idea of the man left behind, already well established in movies. But this, you know, takes it to, you know, into space where the rescue team and, you know, the rescue itself is the movie, because how are you going to get all the way back to Mars and rescue him? Now, what's interesting about it is that Matt Damon's character spends so much time alone wondering if this is it. You know, maybe they're not going to be able to come back to get me, not because they don't want to, but because physics says no. So Ridley Scott shot Matt Damon's solo scenes for 5 weeks straight, after which he was relieved from the schedule. So he did not see, Matt Damon did not see most of his co-stars again until the cast was reunited to promote the film. That seems like a really great strategy, because it would give Matt Damon the chance to really work on that feeling of, yeah, they're out there, but not in my space. I'm all alone here. They actually created a real potato farm on the studio lot with potatoes in all stages of growth so they could be used for filming, and made about 20 sets, which it's not a lot in comparison to other films, but they were more technical. So to put that in perspective, Ridley Scott used 70 on Exodus, Gods and Kings, and over 100 on American Gangster from 2007. So when you watch The Martian, check out the opening title words, The Martian, because it vanishes bit by bit on every letter. It's the exact opposite as the title of Ridley Scott's Alien, which appears bit by bit on every letter until the title is fully readable. Now, Matt Damon was willing to lose a whole bunch of weight for the scene towards the end of the movie, but Ridley Scott said no. Damon had already done it once when filming Courage Under Fire, but he got really sick after doing that and was under medical supervision for a long time afterwards. So they used a body double for those scenes. He has said that on The Martian, buried in the film is a life lesson. God helps those who help themselves. It's a tremendous example of effort and ingenuity and courage in the face of imminent death. It's as tough as climbing Mount Everest, really. In a slip, you can die. So we are really coming to the end of our show. Mike, do you have any last thoughts about Ridley Scott?
Well, one of the best things about The Martian is that it really balances the epic and the intimate. I mean, how few films are able to do that? And so just to reinforce things you were saying about it. Secondly, just to point out that although Ridley Scott has worked in various genres and often quite well, science fiction oftentimes works best for him. Alien, you know, Blade Runner, The Martian. For whatever reason, he has a kind of affinity with that. And a lot of it actually, frankly, goes back to art school days. You're sitting down and you're drawing, you know, you're doing set design, you're doing production design. And then ally that with the slickness, again, using the positive sense of commercial filmmaking from a guy who had his background in making TV commercials, and you can really present a great looking film. And when it clicks, it really clicks, as in the sci-fi films I just mentioned.
So I want to remind everybody that we do have some classes coming up in the fall that we don't offer all the time. Mike will be teaching British film, and we don't know yet whether we will be on campus or not. We are hoping that we will be partially open and that that will be a regular face-to-face class where you can have discussion. And I will be teaching film and philosophy with Dr. Helen Mitchell in the summer and in the fall. And that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.